A Tale of Two Kingdoms, Part 14, Moray, the Good Regent. Okay. Today's lesson, number 14, is called Moray, the Good Regent. That's an optimistic title on my part, since I hope to get all through Moray's regency today. Okay, so the first part is about the end of Mary's reign here. If you recall last time we left off, she had surrendered at Carberry, and Bothwell, he'd returned while they were parlaying, and he was allowed to go free, although they tried to hunt him down later. I think, as I mentioned before, he eventually escaped to Norway, where he unfortunately, for him, ran into some relatives of the woman that he had jilted, and he spent the rest of his life in prison and died insane about 12 years later. Mary was taken back to Edinburgh. She was told that she could regain the throne if she disowned Bothwell, and that she vehemently refused to do. She was also quite surprised that the soldiers and the people of Edinburgh were haranguing her about being a whore and a murderer. Seems she had misjudged the people's temperament about this, the whole thing of her husband being killed and marrying his killer. She was also becoming quite irrational, and according to a sympathetic observer, actually the French ambassador, said, "I expected that the queen would have been gentle with the lords and tried to pacify them, but on her way back from the field, she talked of nothing but hanging and crucifying them all." So, okay, it also transpired that she was pregnant with twins, whom she later miscarried. So, given the sort of rascal, it's not usually a term we apply to women, but I think it's probably fair in this case, nature of the queen, they took her to a more remote and secure location than Edinburgh. They took her to Loch Leven, which is a castle on an island in a loch. That's a lake for you English people. For Americans, yeah. Anyway, she remained imprisoned, I guess partly because she steadfastly refused to disown Bothwell, probably for other reasons too. She was still strong, you know, she's pretty strongly suspected of having conspired to murder her husband. And Knox and the other Protestant ministers were crying out, preaching sermons. She should be tried, and if she were found guilty, she should be punished in the biblical sense, capitally. And since she did refuse to disown Bothwell, they had no reason to let her go or restore her to the throne.
Now she disowned it.
Well, de facto, yeah. At this point, she's still officially queen. But shortly thereafter, what were called the casket letters. They were called the casket letters. A casket was a box, so it's not a 6 foot long box, just a small box, silver box that had these letters that were from Mary, or purportedly from Mary, written to Bothwell. And there's, you know, to this day, I mean, there's been a number, there's been books on these letters and so on, and what they really prove. What they're supposed to prove, that is, she conspired to kill her husband and was committing adultery with Bothwell beforehand or not. They're also purported, you know, a certain number to be forgeries or altered or to other people and so on. So, but anyway, within a few weeks, about, 5 or 6 weeks, she was forced actually to abdicate. Well, interesting enough, one of the representatives smuggled in a letter, which is from Elizabeth's emissary, which actually told her that her life was in danger and that any agreement that she signed under duress wouldn't be considered to be binding. So in any case, she signed, and on the 29th of July, that's 5 days later, 1567, James VI, who was only about a year old at that time, was crowned king. John Knox preached at the coronation service from the book of 2 Kings on the accession of Jehoash, or Joash, and he was the baby that was preserved from Jehu, probably by virtue of the fact that he wasn't going off with all his other brothers, and from Athaliah, the wicked female usurper of the throne. The Earl of Wharton took an oath on behalf of the king, that he would serve God, he would maintain the true religion of Jesus Christ, the preaching of the Holy Word, and do in right ministration of his sacraments, now received and practiced in this realm, and shall abolish and gainsay all false religion to the contrary, or contrary to the same. And out of my lands and empire I shall be careful to root out all heretics and enemies to the true worship of God, that shall be convicted by the true Kirk of God of the aforesaid crimes." Okay, so this was, I guess, the first sort of Protestant oath, but it was actually, there was an act of Parliament after this that actually set up the form of the coronation oath for Scotland. Okay, so I mentioned last week, Moray had left the country earlier in the spring when it was clear that Mary wasn't going to punish the king's murderers. He felt his life was in danger. So he was abroad in France, actually, when he heard that Mary had been captured. And he sent her a letter indicating his support, but then when he found out she wouldn't give up Bothwell, and particularly when he found out of the existence of the casket letters, he wasn't as supportive, certainly. He came to Scotland in mid-August of 1567. He went to see Mary, and after they had some very long and intense conversations, she designated him as regent. I don't know that it was necessary for her to do that, but because the Parliament, in fact, confirmed him as regent. But in any case, he was proclaimed regent on the 22nd of August, and he held that position for 29 months before he was assassinated. And he was called the good regent. That's what the title of the class for today comes from. I think he did a very good job. He was probably, I think I've read several historians comment that he certainly would have made a much better king than Mary made a queen. But since he wasn't legitimate, it wasn't possible. So, regent runs the country for the magistrate who is underage.
For the baby king.
For the baby king, yeah.
And Mary could run the government for the baby king.
Well, she, I guess, acquiesced to that. Yeah. It wasn't really her that appointed. I mean, I don't think it really was her that was appointing him, but I guess it didn't hurt, right? It was kind of like her, Bothwell's divorce. He got divorced in the Protestant church, and then he had the Catholic church annul it. So, okay. Okay, so last week and thus far this week, we pretty much focused on the civil magistrate because we have all these events that we have to keep up with. But what was happening with the church? Well, after Knox's trial for treason, which was late 1563, we haven't talked very much about it, and there's been a few things that happened that are of interest. First of all, Knox's wife had died roughly 1560, and in 1564 he remarried. He married Margaret Stuart, the daughter of Lord Ochiltree, and she was a noblewoman of royal blood, and Mary fumed because Knox had dared to marry someone who was royal, even though he was born of a humble circumstances. And it was kind of ironic that she was mad about him getting married after complaining that he had preached about her marriage. Okay, in 1564, you could say the basic story is that the church really struggled under Mary's reign. They struggled in the sense that the ministers were underpaid, and they didn't really have official recognition because even though Parliament had passed these acts establishing the church in 1560, Mary had refused to ratify them. So they were going on, but they weren't officially settled. There's sort of a recurring theme, and you remember at Knox's trial for treason, there were certain things he said and done, and even before that he had done that caught some of the Lord's eyes, and the Queen's was irritated her. And so in June of 1564 at the General Assembly, there was a disputation about Knox's preaching and his prayers for the Queen. And you'll recall that he prayed that God would enlighten her, it says, if it be his will. And when it was complained about that, he said that he only prayed for it if it be God's will, because we're told to pray in faith, and he didn't have faith that God was going to regenerate her. So, but then that's why he prayed that if it be God's will, that he should. Anyways, Knox offered to debate five propositions before the General Assembly. And so there was a meeting of some lords, and actually Knox and some of the other ministers, and they were again complaining to him about his preaching. And he offered to debate five propositions. And these are fairly important. I don't have the details. I mean, I don't have his reasoning and so on to share with you, but they were that it was lawful for subjects to refuse to obey the king's commands to kill innocent men and to rescue innocent men from the king's hands. That subjects who obeyed the king's commands to kill innocent men were murderers. That God had sometimes ordered subjects to arm against their natural kings and to take vengeance upon them according to God's law. And that God's people have executed God's law against their king, having no further regard to him in that behalf than if he had been the most simple subject within this realm. Okay, these, in a sense, from the, I guess, certainly from the medieval or Renaissance worldview, these were certainly revolutionary precepts. I mean, they changed the relationship between the king and the king's subjects. And interestingly enough, one of the historians commented that Knox's chief antagonist in this debate was this William Maitland of Lethington, one of Mary's advisors. And as you've already mentioned, you know, he's certainly a very learned man. He was probably an atheist, but when they debated, actually this debate, he quoted Calvin, Beitzer. He had a pretty wide range, even of modern Reformed opinions on his side, and Knox only had some declaration of Magdeburg or something like that. I'm not familiar with the declaration, but in any case, the historian said that basically this old preacher was preaching essentially revolutionary ideas, the ideas that would actually take hold in the future, and this relatively young statesman was preaching these old ideas that were about to be swamped by the change in the tide. So, and in fact, right, this is 1564, and 2 years later, right, they basically deposed Mary and took vengeance on her according to God's law, sort of, and had no further regard to her than if she had been the most simple subject in the realm, sort of. But pretty much, I mean, that's, you know, they did depose her basically for violating God's law and for other things. I don't mean to say there wasn't any mixed political considerations, but, you know, Elizabeth was furious with them for doing this because she saw it as a rebellion, you know, an infringement of the rights of the sovereign. Okay, now we've talked about Darnley, right? He's dead, of course, now. But going back to right after he was married, he sat in on a Protestant sermon, actually one of Knox's sermon. And at this very time, Moray was actually absent from the court, and we were soon to come to the chase about Raid. Knox was preaching, and I have a little excerpt here. It's said by a recent biographer that if you read the Knox's sermon here, I mean, this is the only sermon that we actually have extant from Knox, but they said it was actually fairly restrained for Knox's sermons. But the only one that apparently we have written down. And Knox, the reason it's written down is because Knox later was quite controversial, and so like 10 days later he wrote it down from memory, what he had said. But I mean, there's a lot of reports about Knox's sermons, you know, about, I mean, from various observers, like writing back to Elizabeth and so on, saying, you know, that Knox is agitating for the queen to be, you know, tried and so on. And, But anyways, but compared to other reports, this is fairly restrained. But let me just read you a little bit of his sermon. And this was not taken well by Darnley. So Ahab, as in the book of the... I've skipped over quite a bit. He started out by talking about the responsibilities of subjects to not be essentially anarchist, you know, that they were responsible to the sovereign. He's talked about a number of things related to the relationship between kings and their subjects. It comes down to Ahab, and Darnley figured he was talking about he and Mary when he talked about Ahab and Jezebel. He said, "Ahab, as in the book of the Kings is written, received many notable benefits of the hand of God, who did visit him in diverse sorts, sometimes by his plagues, sometimes by his word, and sometimes by his merciful deliverance. He made him king, and for the idolatry used by him and by his wife, he plagued all Israel by famine. He revealed to him his will and true religion by the prophet Elijah. He gave unto him sundry deliverances, but one most special, when proud Ben-Hadad came to besiege Samaria and was not content to receive Ahab's gold, silver, sons, daughters, and wives, but also required that his servants should have at their pleasure whatsoever was delectable in Samaria. True it is that his elders and people willed him not to the proud tyrant. But who made unto him the promise of deliverance? And who appointed and put his army in order? Who assured him of victory? The prophet of God only, who assured him that by the servants of the princes of the provinces, who in number were only 232, he should deface that great army in which there were 32 kings with all their forces. As the prophet of God promised, so it came to pass. Victory was obtained, not once only, but twice, and that by the merciful visitation of the Lord. But how did Ahab visit God again for his great benefit received? Did he remove his idolatry? Did he correct his idolatrous wife Jezebel?" Okay, and of course we know that the Protestants said that the Mass was idolatry, and so this kind of language would not have been unfamiliar to Darnley. "No, we find no such thing, but the one and the other we find have continued and increased in their former impiety. But what was the end thereof? The last visitation of God was that dogs licked the blood of the one and did eat the flesh of the other. In few words, then, we understand what difference there is betwixt the visitation of God upon the reprobate and his visitation upon his chosen. The reprobate are visited, but never truly humbled, nor yet amended. The chosen being visited, they sob, and they cry unto God for mercy, which obtained, they magnify God's name, and afterwards declare the fruits of repentance. Let us therefore, that hear these judgments of our God, call for the assistance of his Holy Spirit, that howsoever it pleases him to visit us, we may stoop under his merciful hands and unfeignedly cry to him when he corrects us. And so we shall know and experience that our cries and complaints were not in vain." Okay, so I clipped this bit about Ahab because that was particularly the part that Darnley was concerned about. And I think you can see it's, I mean, for Knox, this is a fairly restrained sermon. And yet I guess I can understand how Darnley assumed that bit about Ahab was directed at him. Interestingly enough, right, in the event, although we don't have any record of their blood being licked by the dogs, Ahab and Mary and Darnley both suffered sort of similar downfalls to Ahab and Jezebel. So Darnley was murdered, his house was blown up, and Mary was eventually executed because after nearly 20 years in captivity, she was still plotting to overthrow Elizabeth. So, okay, so Darnley thought that Knox was speaking of Mary and himself, and they issued an order that Knox was forbidden to preach in Edinburgh while the king and queen were present. This was a somewhat contentious, and the people of Edinburgh had some kind of formal petition back to the king and queen about this, but in the event they left Edinburgh before the next Sabbath, so he didn't have to leave right away, although he did leave later for his own safety. Okay, I mentioned already that the ministers were suffering. The rest of the country was suffering. The winters of 1563, 64, and 64, 65 were the most severe that anyone could remember, and there were a lot of people starving. You'll recall that they'd come up in 1560 or 61, Mary and the Parliament had reached a plan to pay ministers from some share of the thirds of the benefices, and there was very little, And Mary was petitioned to increase the share several times. In June 1564, she refused. That Her Majesty thinks it no way reasonable that she should defraud herself of so great a part of the patrimony of her crown as to put the patronages of the benefices forth of her own hands, for her own necessities in bearing of her great and common charges will require the retention of a good part in her own hands. In other words, no. So Knox was directed to write a letter by the General Assembly to write a letter of encouragement to the ministers in December of 1565, which he did. He also wrote a letter to the congregation, in other words, the people, and asked them to support their ministers, remind them of the example of Obadiah. Right? Obadiah was Ahab's servant. He hid and fed 100 prophets of the Lord. And in 1566, then they declared a general fast, basically to pray for the state of the church. In, the General Assemblies of the Church were typically sort of June and December. And they met June 25th, 1567, so this was just 10 days after Mary had surrendered. George Buchanan was elected to be the moderator. And Buchanan's a figure that he'll come up more in the next, maybe in the next week or two. He was probably the most learned man in Scotland. He had been educated overseas. When he came, returned, he was actually one of Mary's, he would spend time with her. They both had similar cultural interests. But after Darnley was killed, he became one of her worst enemies, not physically, but he actually wrote a book, something like A Detection of Mary, Queen of Scots.
Why did it seem such a thorn that old Donald be knocked off? I mean, why did the people care? I mean, it seems like it was just a pretense for their general dislike for the king.
Okay, so why did the people care about Darnley being knocked off? Well, I have to say it was mixed reasons. I mean, certainly the Lennox family, right? This was their son. And, of course, they had a lot of alliances and so on where people weren't very happy about that. For some people, it was not so much maybe the murder of Darnley at all as the rise of Bothwell, okay, who was quickly showing him, whereas Darnley had been maybe an extremely ineffective tyrant because he was, so immature, and basically when he didn't get his way, he went off to spend time at, hunting and so on. I mean, not that it's not good to go spend time hunting, but but what's that? Yes, right, yeah. So you're right. That I mean, in fact, some people think it's very hypocritical for some of the lords to, to sort of raise this as an issue. Some of them may have been at least partly implicated. Some of them probably didn't know about it beforehand or knew that something was going to happen. Some people, though, I think the biggest thing in terms of the population was that Mary misjudged the sort of the temperament of the people. I mean, they were certainly in the cities, to some extent, they were reformed, and they did see this, first her husband's killed, and she's probably complicit in it. I mean, I still think that it's probably likely that she was involved in the conspiracy to murder him, certainly lured him back to Edinburgh, and then she marries the killer, and a lot of people believe she was in an adulterous relationship with him. And that didn't sit well with the people. So, I mean, for whatever political reasons that the lords might have had, I think it was a sort of a moral outrage among the people that certainly, was part of it. But, you could see the same thing in our... I'm now speaking very extemporaneously, but you can see the same thing in our own day, right? I mean, why were those congressmen sitting in judgment on Bill Clinton? Well, clearly, for some of them, it was a moral outrage. For others, it was just a way to get at the guy. All right? And others just didn't care. I mean, it was just a political battle for a lot of people. But at the same time, I don't think you couldn't say that there wasn't a fair amount of moral outrage in the country. It's just that there wasn't enough to carry the day. Okay, well, let me continue on here with this General Assembly. They agreed to meet again on the 25th of July. There they subscribed a covenant. This was a number of earls, lords, barons, and other commissioners to establish the church by law, restore its patrimony, etc. And in the next December, just when they met again, they actually appointed some commissioners to represent the Kirk, the church, and parliament. The minister who married Marian Bothwell was disciplined. The minister who pronounced the marriage bans, he was investigated. This was John Craig, but he was exonerated. As you recall, he issued them under with a fair amount of protest, and then Bothwell threatened to hang him if he didn't do it. So, anyways. Okay, so far we've talked, again, now we've talked about the church, but we've again mostly talked about the church leadership and the sort of the intellectual struggles and so on. How did the church itself prosper during the time? I mean, we know it didn't prosper financially, but in 1560, right at the first General Assembly, there were 40 members of the assembly. There were only six ministers. And according to Hetherington, a Scottish historian, there were no more than 12 Protestant ministers in Scotland at that time, 1560. Now, you recall they had somewhat ambitious plan for increasing the number of ministers and readers and so on. And so in December 1567, there were 252 ministers, 467 readers, and 154 exhorters. And so the church had grown enormously during 7 years. So, you know, God had certainly blessed the church, even though they were under very adverse circumstances. Okay, the parliament then met immediately thereafter in December of 1567. And after they ratified Mary's abdication, Morey's appointment as regent, and the previous abolition of papal authority, their main act of business was the church. All right, so the church, they officially settled it. And unfortunately, it's somewhat difficult to get a... I don't have all the acts, you know, the exact text of the acts that they actually passed, but according to James Hewison King, the historian of the Covenanters, he said that they passed 11 acts on the abolition of the Mass, on the true church and churchmen, on presentees to churches, on the coronation oath, on public officials, on thirds of benefices, on schoolmasters, on church jurisdiction, on bursaries, on benefices, on privileges of churchmen. And I'll just have to sort of give you a summary here. The tenor of these acts shows the thoroughgoing nature of the revolution which had been accomplished and the foundations on which civil and spiritual government was to rest. The reformed churches of this realm are declared in Acts 6 to be the only true and holy church of Jesus Christ within this realm. While persons who do not accept the reformed confessions, subscribe the articles of religion, take the sacraments, are not members of the church. The settlement of pastors pertained to the church only. In other words, a civil magistrate couldn't appoint pastors. It was up to the church only. The coronation oath was made imperative, so this acknowledgement of the reformed faith and so on in the coronation oath was made mandatory. Public officials were to acknowledge the reformed church. Okay, the 10th Act asserts the legal right of the church to the proper patrimony, which is the tithes, and ordains the thirds to be paid to the long-defrauded ministers. The 12th Act established the just jurisdiction of the church, the Immaculate Spouse of Jesus Christ. In this way, and he summarizes, in this way Scottish Protestantism had developed, organized itself, and set up its own autonomous government. And only after it had asserted its freedom to act independently within its own sphere, asked the civil power to recognize its separate existence. Magisterial recognition, indicated by the mutual acceptance of a creed, obviously limited that independence. Nevertheless, neither the king nor parliament could justly claim to have conferred on the national church an authority which is inherent. Whereas in England, the jurisdiction of the church is accepted as a gift from the crown, Article 37, while it is held to be of divine appointment at the same time. So we I mean, certainly one of the issues that's going to sort of carry on for the next century further is the establishment of the church and the basis for it. And so, at least at this point, there's a pretty clear declaration that the church is not established by the state, it's established by Christ, but that the state does recognize its existence. Okay, and that becomes an important distinction, because obviously the temptation, maybe not so obviously, but the temptation is there in the next century, well, even the rest of this century, for the government to keep interfering with the church by appointing bishops and settling pastors on congregations and so on. Okay. Once Moria was appointed regent, he had really two serious problems to deal with. First, what to do with Mary and her supporters. The other is how to deal with England. With respect to Mary, she remained imprisoned in Loch Leven. There was now a king's party and a queen's party. Okay, the king's party was the party of King James VI. In other words, the party of the regent. And the Protestant, or the sort of the real Protestant party. Although mixed in with that were a number of, it was sort of a mixed party. And then the Queen's party would be Mary's party, Rob.
How old is James at this time?
He's a year old. Okay. So when I say the King's party, he's not like directing it and having conversations with him. He's still in nappies. Okay. Okay, so what further complicated matters, right, is that some of Moray's supporters of the King's party were really only half-hearted. They would have supported the restoration of Mary if she would disown Bothwell, so this would include Maitland and two Lord Hume and Athol. But Moray, I mean, he was largely successful at obtaining sufficient respect for his authority so as to put a damper on any serious rebellions. But 8 months into his regency, in May of 1568, Mary escaped from Loch Leven. And, Mary had a very dramatic life, and I think that's one reason why she has so many partisans today, is that she just lived such a, all these things have happened to her, right? They all make these great stories. Well, her escape's another great story, and I'll skip over. We'll just suffice it to say she escaped. She fled to the west of Scotland, where... for one thing, the Hamilton family was there. If there's anybody that hated Moray, it was, besides Mary's supporters, it was the Hamilton family. Right? The Duke of Châtellerault was the very elderly head of the Hamilton family. But he had been regent of Scotland, traditionally had been the Hamilton family, so Moray was a interloper from their perspective. Also, some of her other supporters were there, and within 6 days, from May 2nd to May 8th, she raised a force of 6,000 men. And there was a ban signed for her support by 9 earls, 9 bishops, 18 lairds, and over 100 other supporters. And I mentioned this whole idea of covenanting, right? This banding together is something that appears to just be interwoven in the Scottish psyche. I mean, this isn't not primarily a religious document. It may have been a Catholic document, but she escapes, and 6 days later they're all signing this covenant together to restore her to power. And anyway, so they decided to go to the castle at Dunbarton. And en route they passed very close to Moray's. He had a small force of about 4,000 men, smaller than Mary's in any case. And they knew where Moray's force was, and they decided to pass close enough actually to start a battle. They were routed. The Mary's force was routed. She escaped, and she decided to head for England. And she arrived on the 16th of May, 1568. Once she arrived, she was put this in quote, imprisoned. It wasn't immediately clear it was imprisonment, and the circumstances were certainly nicer than, say, the dungeon at the castle of Carlisle or something like that. But in fact, she was never was released, and she was finally executed almost 20 years later. Okay, Maury's other problem was England and Elizabeth, as much as she disliked Mary, despised the idea of subjects judging their sovereign. So at first she demurred from dealing with Moray, but within a few months had softened to the idea. She initially, one of the things the Scots and the English had to work together some on is enforcing the law on the borders. It was a notoriously dangerous region, and thieves would flee from one side to the other. So they had to have some cooperation between law enforcement on either side. And at first she told her border wardens not to cooperate, but then after a few months, they did. Okay, so Elizabeth was in somewhat of a quandary. She didn't want to aid Moray. She didn't want to aid Mary. Now Mary shows up on her doorstep. So Elizabeth finally resolved to hold a hearing. Okay, now Elizabeth would not have accepted the idea that she could. I mean, certainly Mary's subjects couldn't judge their sovereign, but even Elizabeth wouldn't say that she could judge a foreign sovereign. But she didn't really have much choice in the matter, so she formed a commission of arbitration. And the commission basically became subsumed by political considerations. And at the end, Elizabeth finally declared that Moray and his colleagues had done nothing to impair their honor. Okay, there was a possibility they'd be tried for slander for saying that Mary was a conspirator to murder, but also that nothing was said which caused Elizabeth to think badly of Mary. Okay, and this was said by a later historian to be perhaps the most absurd judicial opinion ever left upon record. But the effect, though, was basically the same. It didn't matter because Moray went back to Scotland and ruled there, and Mary stayed in England in prison. So regardless of what Elizabeth said, you know, the situation was, it pretty much just formalized the status quo at that point. Okay, when Mary realized, though, that she was basically left in the same straits as before, she started encouraging a number of the lords in Scotland to rebel. And when Moray came back, because I'm not sure if it was December 1568 or January 1569, but when he came back, he had a number of lords in rebellion and spent quite a bit of time putting down these rebellions. But it seemed to have everything more or less in hand. But on the 11th of January 1570, he was shot by one of the Hamiltons, who's basically a professional hitman. The guy, you know, there was some question initially as what the story was, but the guy knew what Moray's route was going to be, and he put mattresses on the floor to hide his footsteps. He darkened the room, you know, planned his getaway. He removed a keystone from an arch so he could ride through on his horse and so on. He shot him with a musket ball from a second-story window. Hamilton died. Hamilton. Oops, stop. Moray. Yeah, we got to get the right person here. Moray died that night. After, you know, having some time to sort of put his affairs in order. And he was laid to rest in St. Giles Church in Edinburgh. John Knox preached the funeral sermon, and the text was, "Blessed are the dead that die in the Lord," Revelation 14:13, which goes on to say, "For they rest from their works," and I remember the rest of the verse. But anyways, even though Knox had been in and out with Moray, and at one point they were estranged from each other, you know, Moray had basically been a very good regent. He'd been a good friend of the Protestant Church. He'd done as much as he could legally to support the Kirk, and Knox, who was not long for this world at this point, preached his funeral sermon. So I did it. I got through the regency of Moray today. Questions? Mike.
What was happening? Was the Pope
stand by Emily while Mary was being disposed, or was he
hacked? I'm sure the Pope was hacked. There's a lot of, I mean, of course, the Council of Trent had just happened. There are a lot of, certainly modern historians sympathetic to Mary say there was no such thing as a Catholic League and so on. I mean, I haven't done enough research to it to really tell one way or the other. Apparently, one of Elizabeth's political considerations was what was the fact that war with Spain was very near, right? I think the Armada sailed, that year or the next year. Well, an Englishman should surely know when the Spanish Armada was sunk. Simon, what year was it? I think it was 1569. But right in there, the Spanish Armada sailed. That was apparently one of Elizabeth's considerations in not saying Mary was guilty, you know. And so there were definitely other political considerations. And in fact, right, all these intrigues while Mary remained in prison went on, and that's eventually why she was executed for continuing these sort of, you know, various schemes while she was in prison. Bob?
How did they increase the number of ministers? What did they need to become a minister?
Well, they had...
I guess part two to that question is Buchanan. How did he become a minister?
Now, Buchanan wasn't a minister. He was only the moderator of the assembly.
Moderator.
He was actually, he was a lay moderator of the assembly. And they actually chose him because he would be very good at arguing and sort of, you know. What did you have to do to become a minister? Well, you clearly didn't have to go off to seminary. You had to be examined by the church. You'll recall that people who were readers and exhorters, I don't know that's absolutely necessary, but one idea was that they would be training for the ministry. But that's a good question, because you think about all the history that's available, of course, to me, the stuff that I've been reading mostly focuses on, you know, Mary and Knox and all these sort of high-profile people. But that's why I wanted to include that one statement about the growth, because you know we really don't have a good picture, at least I don't, and of exactly, you know, how it grew. I mean, I know that they set in the Book of Discipline, they put together sort of plans to, if you will, grow the number of ministers. But in terms of actually how it worked itself out in individuals' lives, I'm not really sure.
Now, did they have a doctrinal confession at this point?
Mm-hmm. Well, the Scottish Confession of Faith of 1560.
Okay, so they
have
written about it. Yeah. Okay. So they had some way, because it seems like when you grow this fast, you're going to have pastors out there. You really aren't
well
equipped to maintain doctrinal
purity. Well, yeah. Of course, you have to remember these were Scotsmen of the 1500s, not Americans, of the 20th century. I mean,
were they more literate or less?
Well, some of them were a lot more literate, I would say. Yeah. I mean, let's face it, we're not, as a people, we're not exactly intellectual giants. And that's why. Okay, we're lazy, you know, as a culture. And, I'm not saying that they had a high. I don't know that they had a higher literacy rate. I doubt that they did at that point in time. But certainly, the men who were literate, many of them were, exceedingly well trained, I guess. So they had a classical education. I that's a good question. Again, I don't know the details because I don't know enough about that. I guess I've got to get started on reading Andrew Melville's biography, and perhaps that will shed some light on it. He's a... well, very active Protestant who's still fairly young at this point. He's about to come into sort of a... after Knox dies and so on, he kind of comes up on the radar screen, so to speak. So.
I wonder how many of them were previously part of the Catholic Church.
I don't know. That's a, again, that's a good question. So, and if I don't know, and I'm not sure where you could find that out today, because I mean I've got what I believe to probably be the best histories of the church, but they just don't, you know, they tend to focus on the you know, on more on theology and dealings with parliament and so on, than less on the, say, how individual churches grew and got ministers and so on. Maybe there's some sources out there I'm just missing. Okay. Mike, would you close us in prayer?